Good morning, everyone. Time now for our regular roundup of war news from the far corners of the world. First, from our newsroom in San Francisco, here are the latest reports from the Far East and the Southwest Pacific. News from the Far East this morning indicates the grim determination of the United Nations to scourge Japan with a mighty offensive against her home islands. In New Delhi, India, Air Marshal Sir Richard Pearse, former chief of the RAF Bomber Command in Britain, sounded the keynote when he disclosed that the United States had set up an air headquarters in India. Pearse, who earned the nickname Punch'em for his repeated bombings of Europe, said, "We're going to carry the war into the enemy's territory, into Japan." Pearse said the latest models of American and British warplanes are arriving in increasing numbers. Lord Linlithgow, Viceroy of India, told the Indian Chamber of Princes today in New Delhi that in Sir Stafford Cripps, India has a trusted friend on whose fairness she can rely. Linlithgow referred to Sir Stafford's mission to India, where he's expected to iron out differences between native leaders and the Churchill government. In the Burma campaign, it's reported that the British have recaptured the town of Schwagen, 80 miles north of Rangoon. Another step in the strengthening of the Far East against Japanese aggression was the naming of Vice Admiral Sir Geoffrey Leighton, 53-year-old former commander of Britain's China Station, as commander-in-chief of all British forces in Ceylon, the island backline fortress defending India. In Chungking today, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek has ordered an inquiry into the crash of a transport plane which cost the lives of 13 persons, including two American advisors and the head of a British military mission. Cairo, Egypt, this morning reports that Greek officials in exile there estimate that starvation, exposure, and executions have taken a toll of 200,000 lives in Greece in less than a year of occupation. Unless conditions improve, half of Greece's 7 million may be dead before the war ends, according to these sources. Striving to smash Japanese preparations for a possible invasion, the defenders of Australia claim today that heavy new blows had been dealt enemy air bases and shipping in the island-dotted seas to the north. Heavy American bombers were reported to have participated in a broad offensive sweep by the Royal Australian Air Force, during which the Air Ministry in Australia says attacks were made yesterday on a Japanese aerodrome at Dili in Portuguese Timor and on invasion bases at Rabaul and Gazmata in New Britain. Complementing these air blows was the announcement today that a United Nations submarine had sunk 60,000 tons of Japanese shipping in a 15,000-mile foray through Indonesian, Philippine, and Malayan waters. The nationality of the submarine, which docked safely at Perth after surviving several attacks with depth charges and aerial bombs during its 60-day voyage, was not disclosed. The official announcement of the raid on the Japanese aerodrome at Dili, about 450 miles northwest of Port Darwin, indicated that extensive damage had been done. All bombs fell in the target area, said an authentic report. The Japanese announced February 20th that their troops had landed on Portuguese Timor to oust Australian and Dutch troops dispatched there last December. The Australians have reported bombing attacks on Japanese shipping off Dili and Koh Phang, the capital of the Dutch half of the island, but have made no previous mention of the establishment of an enemy air base at Dili. At Rabaul and Gazmata, American and Australian raiders, dodging through fierce anti-aircraft fire, were said to have plastered runways, hangars, and grounded Japanese airplanes with bombs in daring low-altitude attacks. These bases, which helped the Japanese control the vital waterway leading southward between New Guinea and New Britain, are some 800 miles from the Australian mainland. Dispatches from Port Moresby, a strategic port on the south coast of New Guinea, said that the raiders at Rabaul and Gazmata were unopposed by Japanese fighters. Japanese offensive gestures during the weekend apparently were limited to attacks on Port Moresby and Thursday Island in the 100-mile strait separating Australia and New Guinea. Australian fighters broke up the attack on Thursday Island, 30 miles north of Cape York, shooting down one bomber and two fighters and damaging several others, according to the Air Ministry. No casualties were reported. Japanese bombers participated in the attack on Port Moresby, but they were kept at a high altitude by anti-aircraft fire. The Port Moresby correspondent of the Sydney Morning Herald reports that the Japanese had used about 30 planes in their operations over Torres Strait yesterday. He declared the size of this force indicated that the Japanese were bringing up air reinforcements in preparation for large-scale attacks. Melbourne had an air raid scare yesterday when an unidentified plane appeared overhead and anti-aircraft guns went into action. It was announced later that the alarm was caused by an Australian pilot who had strayed off his course and had flown over a forbidden area. And there you have it, a roundup of the news, ladies and gentlemen, from the Far Eastern Theater of the Conflict. That's the news from San Francisco. We take you now across the continent to our newsroom in New York.
You have heard reports from our newsroom in San Francisco, and now we cross the Atlantic Ocean for news from Great Britain.
This is London. John McVane speaking. London heard its first air raid alarm today since November the 1st. The last London daylight alert was early last June. The all clear sounded soon afterward. Listeners in the center of the city heard no planes or gunfire. The sound of the sirens has been heard so seldom these last months in London that the wail had an almost nostalgic association for some listeners. I heard one man say, "Hello, there's old Susan blowing off." And he stood a minute motionless, as though he were remembering far-off things that happened long ago, as an old man might, through a sound or a word, remember his youth. Some people stopped a moment to listen, but most went about their business. On the outskirts of London, the thump of gunfire was heard just before the alarm. It stated that two enemy planes crossed the south coast and headed for London, taking advantage of cloud cover. They were intercepted and chased off. Two aircraft thought to be the same two were heard over the Thames estuary. Reports reaching London from Australia today express the hope that continued hammering by Allied bombers is delaying the Japanese thrust southward against Australia. The most recent Australian air statement says Australian and Allied bombers made a joint raid on enemy-held airfields at Rabaul and Gazmata, New Britain. Information in London this morning indicates that British clearing up operations in the Shwegan area of Burma have been successful, although the reported capture of the town isn't confirmed. British forces are said to be on a line roughly between Tharawaddy and Shwegan. It's authoritatively stated that British patrols are more active in Libya, but this isn't regarded as forecasting immediate operations. No particular significance is attached to the Free French African operations. It's explained here that the Free French saw their opportunity, took it, and did extremely well. British commentators frankly refer to the naval action off Java as a grievous defeat. They talk of the uncannily efficient marksmanship of the Japanese. The Yorkshire Post strikes a hopeful note by recalling that the U.S. fleet hasn't yet exerted its decisive power in the Pacific. The Post says Japan has lost heavily and hasn't got the replacement capacity of American shipyards. Also, her long supply lines are dangerously exposed to sea and air raiding forces, so that for the Allies, the situation is full of sharp challenge and opportunity for counterattack. There is, of course, a great deal of speculation here about the possible effects of the action on Allied sea power. It seems to be pretty well taken for granted that this new blow on top of the loss of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse means that for a time at least, the American fleet will have to carry on the fight alone in the Pacific. Today, the London Daily Herald says something about the Java fight that gives a pretty good indication about what the British people are feeling. The Herald says, "They were our pride, those gallant ships. Exeter, Perth, Electra, Jupiter, Encounter, Stronghold, and the others lost in the Battle of the Java Sea. Brave men sailed them to fight against impossible odds. Some in the night or in the rank blackness of smokescreen were never seen again. Others damaged limped back to fight. But for one after another, there was no return. The seas closed over 12 British and Allied warships. To the last gun, to the last ship, they had fought. They are still our pride." This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Next, here in our New York newsroom, we have a report from Moscow. The lines of Hitler's easternmost advance into Russia cracking wide open this morning under the massed weight of Russian armies surging westward. Moscow says German fortifications are crumbling over a 250-mile front from Orel to the large city of Kharkov and the upper Donets Basin. Moscow declares that the hour of liberation for Kharkov itself is at hand, that big Russian siege guns are shattering German resistance at the very gates of this Pittsburgh of the Ukraine, and that the city's more than 800,000 inhabitants will soon be freed of the Nazi terror. Russian guerrilla fighters are sniping in the streets, and some have returned to the main Russian lines with photographic evidence of Nazi atrocities committed since the German forces took the city last October. They describe the slaughter of 14,000 Russian civilians as a nightmare of atrocities. In the lower Donets Basin, Marshal Timoshenko's armies are said to be pressing against the outer lines of the German base at the Dniepropetrovsk. Other Russian dispatches tell of the death trap below Leningrad slowly forcing the Germans into a tighter and tighter mass at Staraya Russa. Resistance of the entrapped German 16th Army is said to have stiffened, even in the face of tremendous losses. In one action at a large junction point, the Russians are said to have wiped out all but five companies of an entire German Elite Guard Regiment. Nearer Leningrad, Moscow tells of 1,800 Nazis killed in 2 days of fighting. And now, reports from the home front, brought to us by Claude Mahoney, reporting from the newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. When Congress gets down to business this week, one of the first things to come up is the bill to create, for the first time in American history, a Woman's Auxiliary Army Corps. The War Department wants this bill passed, wants to put more than 12,000 women in uniform right away. They'll be used for non-combat duties such as air raid wardens, telephone operators, typists, and other jobs. And they would get a private's pay, $21 a month. In the Senate, the defense will open today in the Langer case, and we may know soon whether or not this North Dakota senator is to get his seat. And Senator Reynolds of North Carolina says that as soon as possible, he'll bring up his bill to raise soldiers' pay from $21 a month to $42. The Senate has the Agriculture Department appropriation bill, which the House cut rather drastically. And two more large business organizations are urging the House Ways and Means Committee to pass a federal retail sales tax. They're the Brooklyn Chamber of Commerce and the National Retail Dry Goods Association. That puts them on the same record with the New York State Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers. They insist the retail sales tax would be less inflationary than any other method of raising the money. And they have other ideas, too. One of them is control of wages and salaries, and another one is relaxation on hours of labor. And they ask that the tax be written so that it would end automatically 6 months after the end of the war. And Senator Thomas of Oklahoma says top flight officials will be asked to come up to the Hill and tell the Senate subcommittee whether they think it will be necessary to draft labor in order to meet the production goals set by Donald Nelson, the war production boss. The secretaries of the Army and Navy will be called before the committee for their views. Nelson has already ordered a special commission to direct distribution of skilled workers, and President Roosevelt has said that no man, woman, or child can escape the consequences of this war. This drafting of labor is somewhat of a problem because there's a little clause in the Constitution against involuntary servitude. But Senator Thomas believes that if labor were to be drafted as soldiers, now that's legal, and then assigned to work in factories or other spots, the courts would sustain it. The Selective Service people are polishing up the goldfish bowl for tomorrow night's drawing of the numbers of the men in the last registration. Those men of 20 and the ones on the other end of the limit, 36 to 44. The drawing will take several hours. Secretary Stimson estimates that we will have an army of 3,600,000 men by the end of the year. With a total of 26 million men registered, the Selective Service people have estimated that a single man's chances of being called in are about 5 to 1. Lowell Millett's slated to go upon Capitol Hill today and speak his piece again about the new $600,000 information center on Pennsylvania Avenue. There's a resolution before a House committee that would prevent the Office of Government Reports, Millett's outfit, from using Public Building Administration funds for putting up the building. The resolution may be amended, allowing the building to be completed, but then making it to be turned over to another agency, a war agency, when it's done. And that's all from Washington at this time.
There you have the latest news as reported by John McVane from London, Claude Mahoney from Washington, and by the newsrooms in New York and in San Francisco. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.